Thinking Aloud from the University of Warwick.
Welcome to Thinking Aloud and the fourth of our series of podcasts. My name is Peter Cohen and I'm here with members of Warwick's Capital Centre, Creativity and Performance in Teaching and Learning, to discuss their research into open space learning. First, can I just ask you all to introduce yourselves?
Yes, my name's Nick Monk. I'm Research Fellow here at the Capital Centre and my job is involved both documenting the work that's taken place here and developing theories around that work and also practising the work myself.
My name's Jonathan Herron. I'm the Research Associate at Capital, which is involved looking at models of practical teaching from Shakespeare right through to philosophy or chemistry. And I also run a theatre company called Fail Better that has been company in residence at Capital since 2008.
My name's Oliver Turner. I'm Office Manager and Research Assistant in the Capital Centre. The first of these positions involves me helping with the day-to-day running of the centre. The second, my research post, involves me assessing the Capital Centre's pedagogical impact across the university.
Okay, and thanks very much for joining us. So the first thing, I suppose, for our listeners is to ask, can you explain briefly what the Capital Centre is, how it came about?
Yes, well, the Capital Centre is one of the Higher Education Funding Council for England's CETLs, or Centres of Excellence in Teaching and Learning, which there were 70 created in 2005. The university received a large grant for the English department at Warwick and the Royal Shakespeare Company to form this CETL that we called Capital, Creativity and Performance in Teaching and Learning. The Capital funding provided two teaching and learning spaces, one of which is a theatrical rehearsal room, the other is a theatrical studio. And we also have a writer's room here, which is used by the English department for their writing programme. The purpose of this collaboration, in its essence, was to look at the way the practices of the theatrical rehearsal room might translate across the disciplines in terms of pedagogy.
And I think one of the central ideas, or one of the founding principles that's been most helpful to us, is the idea that rehearsal is a learning process, and ideas of ensemble create a very positive model of groups that are open to learning, that are creative and generative. As they make, they also learn together and develop over time. And those models of both rehearsal practice and ensemble learning have been really quite central to how we work with departments across the university.
Yeah, Johnny's absolutely right there. And it all began with Shakespeare, really, and the teaching of Shakespeare. And the intention was to take the English department's Shakespeare and Selected Dramatists course, which is compulsory for all English majors in the university, and think about different ways to teach that course. It might sound obvious that Shakespeare should be taught by way of performance, but in fact it isn't. Very few universities in the country teach it that way, although schools often do. And the idea was to teach Shakespeare without chairs. So students would come into the spaces, they would be then confronted with an open space, and they would be required, as Johnny says, to work in that space with the tutor to create their own knowledge and understanding of the material, as opposed to sitting in a seminar room and receiving knowledge from an all-seeing, all-knowing tutor.
I'd like to talk a bit more about this distinction that you're making, because we talk obviously about a theatrical studio, a theatrical rehearsal mm-hmm. room, without chairs, teaching through performance. But this isn't acting, is it?
No, it's absolutely not acting, and we're at some pains to say that acting is not a requirement for people to enter the spaces and work in this way. It's not about judging people's technical abilities to perform. This is about embodied learning. It's about experiencing the learning materials both intellectually and physically. You can do both in these spaces.
Mm. And in that sense, it's inactive or performative, but you're not necessarily rehearsing a role or building a character. You're actually using the methods from drama or applied theatre or even more contemporary performance practices to explore a text or an idea or part of the curriculum. And in that sense, you're not acting. Although a colleague of ours who works on the project, Professor Jonathan Nealands, does talk about how certain aspects of being an actor in a democratic situation should be one of the values of the process, in that we all have a responsibility to the learning that's happening, and therefore our active part, how we act within that community, is actually a fundamental principle of the work also.
And that's interesting, that word democracy, because of course in modern theatrical practice, so often the figure of director is often an auteur kind of figure. Mm-hmm. But obviously, we're going back almost more to a Shakespearean kind of ensemble, to that idea of kind of a more level playing field. And how easy is this to introduce into a classroom where, of course, traditionally you would have a teacher teaching down to students and it would be a more autocratic environment? How does democracy map onto that model?
Well, I think what you have to do as a facilitator in those environments is to uncrown power, is to say, I'm a variety of expert in this space, but I do not control the learning in this space, nor am I telling you the information that you have to receive. And that's something of a risk. You say, I'm no longer the source of power in this room temporarily. You guys are here to experience what you experience as part of your relationship with whatever the learning materials are, be they texts or objects or video or whatever it happens to be in there. And that's a key element in there. Also, you've got to be able to be willing to encourage play. You know, there's a combination in these spaces of playfulness and mindfulness, and you've got to be willing to accept that. And sometimes that's a risk. Tutors find it undermining sometimes. There's also an injunction we offer to students that it's okay to fail in these spaces. It's okay to try things out. They're laboratories. They're a place of experiment. It doesn't matter if you fall flat on your face in these spaces, not literally, but figuratively, because they're safe, you know, spaces in which that's permitted.
Mm-hmm. Fail again, fail better.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the strongest educators and practitioners and even auteurs recognise that risk-taking, repeated acts of failure can be generative and can be part of how a concept is created or how learning takes place. So rather than agreeing on an abstract concept or objective that's predetermined before learning takes place, part of the openness of the learning and of the space is whoever is actually in position of authority or managing the situation is allowing that openness to be part of the process and allow the concept or the objective of the session or the production to be a gradual becoming rather than something that you've decided from the beginning.
One interesting implication that comes off that then of open space learning is one of assessment, whereas if kind of the materials which could be brought to a class are very open and it's about a kind of open-end experience rather than the predetermined objective, mm-hmm. is there a difficulty there with assessing that in terms of kind of how you catch that in, for example, a final exam?
No, there isn't a difficulty with assessing it. There's a regulation in the university that permits a performance to stand for an exam, and that's how we use that regulation to say, right, if students wish to create a performance as part of their assessment at the end of this process, then they're able to do so. And in terms of the practicalities of that, what we do is to transfer the assessment criteria for essays into those that we use for performance. So it's they're not being judged really any differently from students in any other way.
And a performance or a presentation might be an even more potent way of recording summative learning or summative assessment. But also, you know, assessment and examination, whatever its form, is always to some extent about performing. And the other thing about the process that we use is that it actually allows far more opportunities for assessment, particularly formative assessment as well, through reflective journals, through documenting the process digitally, and of course it's much more open to perhaps more processual, process-based methods of assessment.
Which I would imagine the students find very useful, finding different ways of capturing their experience and different ways of kind of being evaluated rather than that kind of that artificial final.
It's more multimodal in that sense, in that they might be able to negotiate how they're being assessed or how they choose to record their learning. So it may be that some want to write, and writing is still part of this work, but it may be that others want to respond more creatively or digitally in response to the criteria.
I mean, some students find this thoroughly unsettling. And that's to be expected, you would do. It's all very new. If you're a student who comes to university expecting to write essays and take exams and to be confronted with these rather radically different methods of assessment is somewhat challenging. And, you know, people quickly get used to it out from my experience, and Johnny says are frequently happier with it and derive more from it.
Well, I was going to ask, how are you finding that the students experience this? Because on the one hand, as you say, there's this kind of added element of risk and danger, but the rewards also seem to be that much greater. And how do you find them? Do you find them kind of jumping in feet first, or is there a more tentative?
Yeah, they're initially cautious. I teach a course called Drama Performance and Identity, and students, when they first experience the open spaces there, are not really quite sure what to expect and how to deal with it, because the learning becomes their responsibility. But I have to say that in interviews, students have said that, you know, they've never been on a course that's been better attended than that one, for one example. And they also claim that they're doing much, much more reading than they would do otherwise. And I think, you know, if you free students to do this in these environments, then they're likely to take it on and
take ownership of
their learning, exactly.
I think the big hurdle you have is something touched on at the beginning about this perception that this is performance and acting, and that puts a lot of students off, when in fact all this is using very sound and effective conventions and traditions to facilitate a very rich learning process, and getting across that message is perhaps the biggest hurdle of them all. But one thing I can say about having done this and latterly researched this is the way in which this kind of learning, despite being fun and social and engaging and all these wonderful things, is still very challenging and still forces you to participate and think for yourself. And as Nick says, do your own research and work as well. This isn't about having a laugh. This puts the onus on the students very much to generate the knowledge and curriculum content, just as it puts the onus on the lecturer or the facilitator.
I mean, I think in that sense they have to engage totally or experience it for themselves before they can make a judgment about how it's affected their learning. We sometimes find students are, as might be expected, quite apprehensive about this idea of doing a performance-based workshop. I mean, I've run a lot of workshops, for example, for first-year English students who are looking at Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot, and also first-year chemistry students who are exploring the periodic table. And there's equal levels of apprehension, as might be expected, about going into a practical space that's associated with performance. However, this apprehension almost always gives way to a sense of enjoyment, a sense of engagement, and usually that's what's documented on the student evaluation forms after the sessions. And then they're far more open to doing something like that again.
We're talking about these kind of methodologies, and you mentioned there kind of that you've been working with both chemistry and English students. We'll come back to that question of interdisciplinarity. I suppose what I'd like to ask then is what are the kinds of methodologies you're using in these spaces? Because as you pointed out, it's not acting. So maybe perhaps some practical examples of the kinds of things you're doing with students.
Well, we're certainly using a lot of methods from drama education initially, in that we are using inactive approaches, therefore things that have to be embodied. For example, that might include creating tableaux, still images, that represent through body and space an idea or a particular moment in a text or something like that as a kind of icebreaker. Other ways we might actually introduce physical approaches might involve doing work with the voice. It might do pair work, might be a safer way into some of this or small group work. If the groups aren't ready to sort of get up and do something practical immediately, it might be that you have to scaffold it in the approach. So lots of group work, lots of pair work, things that are fun, things that are embodied, and usually all of those things have to be connected to why people are in the room. So there needs to be some relevance between the activities that you're doing and the text or aspect of the curriculum under investigation. That's very important.
I agree. I mean, a specific example is the workshops we do with the first-year chemists, in which students are required to go away and learn about and research an element that's been allocated to them in the first term by their tutors. They then come into the rehearsal room or the studio, and through a gradual process of the kind that Johnny's described, they then become their element. They embody certain aspects of the characteristics of that element, which was a real gift to us because, you know, these elements have characteristics that are fairly easily described at some levels. And, you know, when students are actually required to interact with each other as their elements, you get some very interesting results. But this is a kind of perfect example of what Johnny was saying about embodying the knowledge.
And very much seems to go back to that aspect of, I mean, the idea of kind of students in a creative space becoming their elements. You know, it sounds like fun, but this feeds into this idea of kind of play, but not play as mucking around. Play is something kind of very focused and
serious play and reflective practice. So they don't just come, have the experience, go and then leave and not have any opportunity to actually reflect on what has happened in relation to some aspect of their curriculum. So as part of each session, there would also be regular questions, discussions, often in pairs, often in small groups, but sometimes as a whole group activity, or sometimes as something that might actually be an active plenary or performed in itself. But there has to be connections made or started to be made between the curriculum and the play that is happening in that space.
And what these workshops have in common with seminars, interestingly enough, is still this idea of dialogue and discussion. Just because all these very generative exercises are taking place, it doesn't mean you don't come together and talk about this and explore these things verbally. But what you find is, and this is from my own experience, is the dialogue and the discussion is all the more richer because it's not been simply facilitated by one person at the head of the classroom or studio space. It's the space has been commanded by students. They've done the work. They've created their own stimuli and their own points of discussion. And they've explored this work physically and socially as a group. And that gives them so much more sort of resources to draw from when they come back together and talk. So the dialogue itself is richer than it would be in a seminar in many, many cases.
It seems to be a very rich mnemonic function as well. I mean, the idea that from my understanding, the idea is that if you're embodying these ideas as well, discussing these ideas, your ability to recall and re-explore these ideas. I mean, can you say something about the theoretical ideas kind of underpinning this?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for a long time, and it's been very persistent, this idea that there's a kind of dualism between mind and body, which goes back to Descartes, of course. And this is increasingly treated with scepticism in philosophy departments and other places across the academy. However, we still teach that way. We still teach on the basis that our bodies are simply carriages for our brains. And this is not the case. Modern neuroscience shows that the two are intimately linked. You know, one doesn't obviously function without the other. And this applies as much to intellectual endeavour as it does to any other kind of activity. So what we're addressing in these spaces is precisely this. We're saying this is a much, much better way of remembering and understanding material because you're involving all your faculties in the process.
And there's a pretty strong pedagogic foundation, perhaps picking up on ideas from Gardner or Kolb, around kinesthetic learning and various intelligences that aren't just about auditory learning, which tends to be the dominant mode, particularly if one thinks of lecture and seminar in the academy. But we obviously are using predominantly kinesthetic approaches and visual approaches, and often tends to be a very potent way of learning. In fact, some people will only learn in this way, in that sense that the kinesthetic means embodied, it's in the body, it's practical, I have to do it in order to understand what it is, and the visual obviously will enhance everybody's learning experience because suddenly an increasingly visual digital age, our teaching might need to include far more imagery than it traditionally has done.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the impression I have with kinesthetic learning is that it's already, for some years now, it's had some kind of impact at school levels, but it seems that the further up the kind of the educational ladder you get, the less it's embedded. And why do you think there is a particular resistance to this in higher education that's only now starting to be overcome? And if so, why?
Yes, I do. It's clear from the studies that have been done. There's a study by Neil Thew on the teaching of Shakespeare in higher education that says that only about 9% of Shakespeare is taught in ways that involve kinesthetic learning in universities. And this does not reflect practice in schools a lot of the time. There's a great deal of work done in a practical way around Shakespeare in schools. And universities have not caught up with this. And there's a very strongly rooted tradition of the lecture and seminar to which the establishment is fairly well wedded. And sometimes this is not for good pedagogical reasons, it's for good economic ones. You know, it's a lot easier to teach 250 people in a lecture theatre than it is to divide those 250 people up into 10 groups and ask a practitioner to work with them in the kinds of spaces we've got. So this is something that's going to be very difficult to overcome.
And there may be a perception around kinesthetic approaches not having the same level of seriousness as other approaches. However, I mean, there has always been and needs to be a strong kinesthetic dimension to all university life. I mean, one thinks of practical subjects such as engineering or business or theatre studies, all of which may involve large theoretical elements but still are functional practices that are about embodied experience. And the idea that you as a student of engineering, business or theatre are not going to take part kinesthetically at all in your higher education is fundamentally absurd.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think there's a lot of hierarchy and power surrounding knowledge, and university is perceived to be getting near the pinnacle of that knowledge. And I think that's where this issue Johnny's just brought up about seriousness comes in. You know, we're getting near the sort of, if you're an undergraduate, you're not far off being a postgraduate, and you're not far off being a doctoral student now. So you need to be getting down to some serious work, and that means knowing your stuff and doing it the right way, doing the way it's been done for many a long year, and that's simply. Whilst is the predominant viewpoint, doesn't hold up to a lot of very credible educational research, which shows that other forms of learning can offer an awful lot to a student's curriculum and their learning experience in higher education or in school.
I think that's quite a powerful kind of thing you've picked up on there, the idea that kind of that play and this kind of playful learning we talk about is something you do when you're a kid, and that when the real learning has to start, that's when you get into the seriousness. I suppose kind of it'd be interesting then to ask kind of how you are practically, because what Warwick from my perception is kind of starting to really lead the way with ideas of inactive learning across disciplines. How are Capital Centre kind of operating? I mean, we've talked briefly about chemistry, but how are they kind of making? How are you making an impact in these more kind of traditional areas in bringing an active learning into a real kind of undergraduate and postgraduate context?
Well, there's only one practical way to do this, and this is through collaboration. You can't impose this on departments. You can't impose it on individual tutors. You need, first of all, the space. You need, secondly, the practitioner to work in that space, and you need the subject specialist. And it's only in that triumvirate do you get this to work. It's only there that the space can be opened up, in which this kind of rich and embodied and kinesthetic type of learning can take place. So without those three elements, you really will struggle. And this is something we learned along the way. We didn't really know that to start with. What we tended to do to start with was to parachute people in from theatre companies to work with students. And very often this was very interesting and a wonderful experience for those particular students, but it wasn't doing anything about improving how much they knew about their subjects.
And I think that there's a real interest in creative approaches across these disciplines. So we've been doing various work, as has already been mentioned, with chemistry, but also with social sciences, with the business school, with the medical school, who all articulate a kind of necessity of creative approaches, even at the top level of their discipline, and certainly in the real-world practice of their discipline, that in difficult times, creative approaches and actually the ability to play becomes all the more important to find, you know, solutions to difficult problems. And part of how we've kept the processes that we've been designing and delivering creative has been to create these unusual connections between academics and practitioners, and these, exactly as Nick says, these collaborations which rely on a kind of mutual respect, but also a mutual sense of taking risks and being creative and having a go.
Is that real world connection particularly important? I'm aware of some of the departments mentioned here, you know, law, business, medical school. There's a real mix between kind of not necessarily ivory tower academics, but people who've come from a very academic group, but also a lot of tutors who've come in from the professional route.
Yeah.
And it is the kind of is there a distinction there between the kinds of people who like to get involved in this kind of activity?
Not necessarily a distinction, but I think it's important to recognise that those who have a more vocational focus to their academic study might be more prepared to do something practical, but not necessarily something more abstract. I mean, I do work with philosophers who are also in the real world, but might be more willing to try an abstract aesthetic idea through performance than a lawyer who wants to know how they can develop their presentational skills. So for various different reasons, you might have different levels of commitment from these different groups, and the perception of their discipline in relation to the perception of something called reality might be a factor, and you need to be aware of it, but you can play with it in very different ways.
What you just mentioned as well about skills is interesting, because one of the early things the Capital Centre was very involved in was running kind of skills-based workshops, you know, presentation skills, for example. Is there a danger of this work being kind of relegated to that all-purpose transferable skills category? Because people obviously understand the value of that straight away, but getting it into proper research, you know, primary research, primary educational strategy, is that more difficult?
I think there's a strong case for some of the work we do being skills based in that way. You know, we've talked about the transferable skills of the actor in that sense in presentations, and there's various things that one can offer to, say, law students, as Johnny mentions, that are just extremely practically useful. But I do think that the actual process of open-spaced learning is much more subtle than that, and what students pick up in their subject learning in our spaces is additional benefits that are around teamwork. It's about levels of self-esteem, it's about how they regard themselves within groups, it's about developing more sophisticated responses to individuals in these particular environments. There's all kinds of things I think will be beneficial to them in an increasingly complex world. You know, it's a kind of, almost in some ways, a rehearsal for life when they get out of university, in microcosm, a lot of what we do. So therefore, it is skills-based, but it's also, I think, more sophisticated and complex than that. And I'm not sure we've really got to the bottom of that yet. I think there's a lot more work to be done there.
And I think that's because it's inquiry-led, in a sense, and that's what keeps it of immediate value and relevance to a research community. You know, we have a strand of this that is practice-based research. We have questions that we're pursuing around pedagogy and around knowledge through practice, and that protects it from being a purely skills-based approach, because then we are thinking theoretically about the practice.
Yeah, and I think the important thing is you don't sit these students down and talk about skills and these are important skills you need to learn. They're just part of the process, and they're picked up almost accidentally along the way. But I don't think it's about sort of singling these skills out, ticking boxes, and here you go. It's just they're in the pedagogy. They're contained within the pedagogy itself.
One thing which I'd like to kind of pick up on from that as well, and coming back to something Johnny said earlier, is about spaces and environments. The Capital Centre has obviously been very fortunate in having this grant which allowed us to build these. Our listeners can't see them, obviously, but these wonderful spaces that we're in at the moment, these studios and rehearsal rooms. How space specific are these kinds of activities? Because obviously, they're more difficult to perform in, for example, a cramped office type teaching space.
Yeah, you can't do this in somebody's office in the humanities building. It's not possible, because what you do when you open the space up is you remove those hierarchical relationships. As Ollie said earlier, you no longer have the tutor at the head of the class downloading information into these acolytes that he or she has in front of them. And the space immediately transforms those relationships. There's not those arrangements. It means immediately that students in the open space become participants in the process of learning, as opposed to recipients of somebody else's knowledge.
So is there a way of creating these spaces if you don't, for example, have a £5 million
grant? You can do it any way you like, as long as the space is basically without chairs and you don't allow people to sit down and you don't take up a position as tutor at the head of the room in front of the whiteboard with a marker.
I mean, the history of this kind of work is usually preceded by a symbolic clearing of chairs and desks to a wall. And that might be necessary in order just to find a space that's going to better create learning than what the space is telling you. It's about, because often spaces dictate what learning's going to take place, and they set up certain expectations about the kind of relationships that will happen in these spaces. And sometimes it's just very helpful and very productive to just clear all of that away and just start with something empty or something open. But of course there is, within this dialogue, an important campaigning factor to what we're doing about building different kinds of spaces, about affecting policy about learning spaces and policy about how institutions, whether they're schools, universities or elsewhere, how they construct spaces for learning. And therefore this is part of a much wider debate.
Johnny's right about this. There's a lot of talk about social learning spaces now in higher education. And what that means, basically, is the kind of work we're talking about, which promotes a different kind of learning. And there's spaces all over the country now being designed with something as simple as having all the furniture on wheels, which means that it can be moved out of the way easily, so the space becomes a multi-purpose one. It's also having mobile IT in these spaces, so that it's not rigid or fixed. It's about having mobile whiteboards and things as basic as that. And this is really beginning to happen quite frequently in a lot of new spaces in the university. And you know, people are starting to call it future-proofing, in the sense that these spaces become amenable to all kinds of different kinds of learning.
Is there a move? I'm interested in what we're saying about you know, creating this symbolic kind of clearing of chairs and this idea of future-proofing. Obviously, these spaces, as they're designed, they're still being designed by pedagogues rather than students in the most sense. But is there a sense that we're moving towards, ideally in the future, you know, the kinds of environment where students can create their own learning spaces, you know, almost individually tailored or group tailored? Or will there always be a kind of pedagogic imperative to impose certain frameworks of space?
I think there's a pedagogic imperative to look for the kinds of spaces that promote the most efficient learning. I think that's, you know, if ideally where we all should be coming from. I'm not sure that we always are, but that should be the imperative, and that certainly involves consultation with students, because you need to research what the outcomes are in terms of learning. You also need to research what students' immediate responses are to spaces and how they feel themselves that they learn. And also there's a lot of work that needs to be done with tutors about space and how they feel that space is best utilised.
Would you like to say a bit more about some of the specific projects you've been involved in? Because we've been talking a lot about kind of the general ideology of the space, but I think our listeners would be interested to hear about some of the...
Well, one thing we haven't mentioned is our student ensemble, which has emerged from work that I've been doing with the undergraduate community as part of my theatre residency here. And that's led to a group of between 25 and 30 undergraduates who are involved as either performers or in production or creative roles as theatre practitioners. And they have regular creative projects. We've recently organised a new work festival, and we've taken performances away from this campus towards either Edinburgh Festival or to the local theatre in Coventry called the Belgrade. But of course, within the context of open space learning, these students as performers are able to become applied theatre practitioners. So we've been able to draw upon student ensemble who are more used to working in practical spaces, or perhaps able to work through role in certain learning experiences. We've been able to use them, for example, in a training session we do called practical networking, which is for early career academics, people who are thinking about teaching undergraduates and postgraduates, sometimes for the first time, as well as how they might carry themselves in terms of their academic practice. So we use members of the student ensemble as in characters working in role for training purposes, but also having them in other spaces, for example, in the philosophy environment, creates a different kind of group dynamic. So you have people who are more used to working through practice alongside people, or perhaps encouraging people who are less sure about the approach. So that's been a really useful project, really useful resource.
It sounds like a very kind of useful long-term kind of planning for kind of continuing this kind of support.
Absolutely, and it's a way about making, you know, a theatre company's residency more embedded in an institution that will allow the theatre company to continue to evolve, but also to leave some work ongoing and open within the institution, in that there is a self-reflective cycle of student ensemble players working across the university, even after they've been working with the theatre professionals.
And Ollie, you've been working on documenting, capturing some of the responses to this kind of work.
Yeah, and specifically for something called the Graduate Pledge, which is a sort of a scheme or project that's taken place between King's in London and Warwick in Warwickshire universities, and that's been interrogating ways in which learning in higher education can be enhanced and improved. They've had a sort of focus on something called academic literacy, which I won't go into now, but hopefully you can extrapolate something from the name, and interdisciplinarity, which has been more my focus. And that's essentially been looking at ways in which different university departments and different areas of knowledge, which are usually or very often kind of fiefdoms and cut off from other parts of the university, can cooperate, collaborate, and generate new types of knowledge and new ways of learning together. And I've been focusing on capital's role in this. So I've been focusing on the collaboration between capital and chemistry, which has seen some, which has been done in dialogue, in conversation with academics and staff from the chemistry department between Nick and Johnny, and that's seen some very, very useful interventions on the chemistry curriculum. In addition to their lab time, lecture time and seminar time, they've now had this sort of fourth space in which they do various workshops. I've been looking at philosophy and literature, which Johnny's had some involvement with, and he's been using you've done various workshops on Kierkegaard, and you've been using performance techniques and drama education conventions to you know, enrichen that, and that's had an overwhelmingly positive response from students. So, and I the list goes on. So this idea of open space learning and of a practical pedagogy goes hand in hand with many other innovations and important sort of discoveries in recently in higher education, such as notions of interdisciplinarity. You know, how can we cooperate both in terms of curriculum content and by using pedagogies from other disciplines to uncover and to trouble curriculums from other areas of knowledge.
I mean, I'd just like to add to that this notion of an open or third space, which is also metaphorical. I mean, there's the open space and the third space that exists between the theatrical rehearsal room and the classroom. You know, what we have here is neither one nor the other. It's something that's a different space to that. And what happens in these open spaces is that there's a kind of neutrality that exists there. They're not freighted with the baggage of either of the first or the second space. They're different to that, and in that there's a freedom in which ideas can blossom. And that works as well for any of these binaries that we see across the disciplines. If you put the two together, you're careful about it, you'll open a third space in which something new can develop.
There's a philosophy of open-minded and open-endedness, exactly. As well as being physically
precisely.
Open.
Precisely. Mm-hmm.
And just to bring this full circle, Nick, you're working on a book to come out of this, kind of bring open space learning back into kind of the traditional academic form.
Yes, I've co-authored with Carol Rutter and Jonathan Nealands and Johnny. We've been commissioned to write a book called Open Space Learning, a Transdisciplinary Pedagogy by Bloomsbury, which will be the first in their series of interdisciplinary studies in the humanities, and that'll be published in three forms, in an online version, in a traditional book version, and in a third version which features various elements of video and bibliography and workshop plans and audio.
Even
in publication, yeah. It's important to think about some more than traditional scribal approaches. So, as Nick's pointed out, there are various interesting digital innovations around how this text is being published. But also, it's important to say that, of course, the text only exists through practice, because it is about practice, and that is our conviction.
Yeah. And with this launching a new series, of course, hopefully that'll see Capital kind of extending its impact outwards and into this kind of wider...
We hope so.
..pedagogy forum, yeah. Cool. Okay, well, I'd like to thank you very much, Nick, Johnny and Ollie. This has been Thinking Aloud with the Capital Centre team, and we'll hope to see you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.